Now I understand why Palestinians hate Israel. I mean, to have that type of statement in the American media in a dignified way, it was just surprising.
A Palestinian-American teenager beaten by Israeli soldiers prompts new perspectives in U.S. reporting. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The creator of a high-minded new super PAC uses a curious metric to describe why campaign finance reform is necessary.
There's no more than 150,000 Americans who are the relevant funders of campaigns. That's about the same number of people as are named Lester in the United States.
One journalist witnesses some chilling scenes while reporting on the current influx of young migrants crossing the southern border.
A group of people who had come out to protest against several busloads of children who were being brought into their community for processing. And one of the women was holding a sign that said, "Not our children, not our problem."
There's more coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is at its deadliest in years. As Hamas rockets launch into cities and towns in southern Israel, Israeli bombs pummel the Gaza Strip. Palestinian sources say that the Palestinian death toll has surpassed 100. This recent surge in violence was fueled by a horrific series of events.
We have breaking news out of Israel right now. TV stations there are reporting that three Israeli teenagers kidnapped in the West Bank have been found dead.
Just hours after they were buried, a 16-year-old Palestinian, Mohammed Abu Khader, was abducted. His body was later found burned. The early autopsy results show he was alive when he was set on fire.
It's widely assumed he was killed in an act of revenge by Israeli extremists.
Abu Khadir's Palestinian-American cousin Tariq was attacked and beaten by Israeli forces as he attended a protest after the murder.
That Palestinian-American teen, 15-year-old Tariq Abu Khadir, was visiting family in Jerusalem from Tampa, Florida. A video that is said to show Israeli police beating and kicking him and photos of his battered and swollen face have circulated widely online, fueling outrage and extensive coverage in the U.S. media. Philip Weiss, co-editor of MondoWeiss.net, says the attack on Tariq Abu Khadir has prompted a landmark moment in coverage of the conflict.
Both the Washington Post and New York Times covered this in a way that I have not seen in the past. At the top of the front page of the New York Times, you saw a three-column photograph of Tariq Abu Khadir, badly beaten, his face is still misshapen. In the Washington Post, they had a video interview where the kid got to say, I don't know why they did this to me. I was just watching. I wasn't throwing stones.
I don't know why they hit me that hard. I fell asleep from how hard they hit me. I went unconscious.
I was both surprised and pleased to hear the NPR report by Daniel Estrin, in which he quoted Tariq's mother, Suha Abu Khadir, saying, "Now I understand why Palestinians hate Israel."
After actually coming and going through it, I don't blame these people for hating, for having so much hate for Israel.
I mean, to have that type of statement in the American media in a dignified way, relating the Palestinian experience, it was just surprising.
So tell me about the coverage on mainstream TV outlets. Did you see a shift there as well?
I was really amazed to see that Ayman Mohideen on NBC News was going to the grave of Mohammed Abu Khadir, who was the 16-year-old abducted last week, going to that grave with Tariq Abu Khadir, who was Mohammed's cousin, who was so badly beaten.
I feel so bad. I feel like I missed the chance to see him for the last time.
I mean, it was just a tremendously moving moment, and I think we have to acknowledge that here's an Egyptian-American reporter, Mohideen, with a Palestinian-American boy. It just reflects a degree of diversity in the reporting. And Jake Tapper grilled Israeli spokesman Mark Regev on CNN the other day.
Mark, Palestinians say this happens all the time. The only difference is that this kid was American.
He even asked Regev if this isn't part of the culture of Israel, which is a narrative that we have not heard much in the American mainstream.
How do these stories differ from what you're used to seeing? Is it simply that they're there at all?
Here, I would contrast that to the coverage of, say, Emily Hanakowitz, a Cooper Union student just 4 years ago when she was shot with a tear gas canister. She was protesting specifically an Israeli attack on a Turkish relief ship, the Mavi Marmara, in which 9 Turks were killed. She's an American citizen. She's an artist. She lost an eye. This could have been a big story. There wasn't a lot of coverage of Emily's disfigurement in the American press.
And why do you think that is?
Well, it's been 4 years, and I think that there's a certain understanding that Israel's response to the continuing resistance to occupation is going to be violent. That impression has built since 2008-09, the Gaza invasion, and then the attack on the Mavi Marmara, which she was protesting. Instead of traditional treatment of this violence as being necessary for Israeli security, or it's part of a cycle of violence, we're beginning to see a narrative on the mainstream that says this is a product of occupation, that you can't have a military occupation for nearly 50 years without producing resistance. So I think that the American mainstream discourse is beginning to reflect a more international understanding of the conflict, which is that military occupation produces resistance.
Many besides Tariq's mother have noted that if he hadn't been an American citizen, he wouldn't be in the news. According to the Defense for Children International Palestine, 214 children have been detained in Israel as of May, and Palestinians are charged in military courts where the conviction rate is nearly 100%. Will this bump in coverage have any real impact on how the conflict is covered more broadly?
I think it will. Traditionally, people said Israel is only acting out of its security needs or there's a cycle of violence. The new narrative now is, no, this is occupation, and this is the abuses that happen to people under occupation. That's the narrative I see. This is now becoming something of a mainstream trend, and you and I both know when there's a good story that's a new narrative, journalists will jump on it. I have a friend who said to me, you know, my view of Israel was set by that Life magazine cover in 1967 of those bronzed Israeli soldiers in the Sinai lounging on a tank after they destroyed the Egyptian army. And she said, you know, here were these people who were destroyed in Europe, who had finally found a country of their own, and they were, you know, triumphant against 5 invading armies. That's what she believed. And, you know, without going into what's true and not true about that history, we're in a different moment now.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Brooke.
Philip Weiss is co-editor of MondoWeiss.net, a news website covering American foreign policy in the Middle East from a progressive Jewish perspective. This week, President Obama has been in Texas to promote his request for $3.7 billion from Congress for emergency funds to address the border crisis. His visit to Texas came after 2 weeks of overheated reporting about a surge in unaccompanied minors who are crossing the border illegally.
A gigantic, unprecedented surge of minors, most without parents or guardians, crossing our southern border on their own by the thousands.
The sheer number of unaccompanied children, barely older than toddlers.
A massive surge of illegal immigrants is underway right now, and we do mean massive. This is unprecedented. Leaked pictures show hundreds upon hundreds of children packed like sardines into detention centers.
This is serious and it is unprecedented, but it's not quite as described. Bob Ortega is a senior reporter for the Arizona Republic. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
So the way the media has been presenting this, you'd think that there's a tidal wave of 5-year-olds washing up on our shores. Is that what's happening?
No, not really. A lot of the unaccompanied minors who are coming across are teenagers, 14, 15, 16, 17. They are, in fact, many of them traveling alone. But most of the younger children that we're seeing are coming across with family, or in some cases being brought across by coyotes.
Coyotes being those who ferry people illegally for lots of cash.
Yes, exactly. And those who are crossing the border unaccompanied generally are not traveling the entire distance from Central America to the border unaccompanied. In most cases, they are traveling with an adult.
So the numbers issue. Actual immigration statistics suggest that immigration's actually coming down, right?
Well, if you compare the numbers of migrants who have been apprehended by the Border Patrol in the last year or so to the numbers from, say, the mid-2000s, when more than a million a year were being apprehended, they're down considerably. We're looking at probably a slightly larger number this year, but not significantly. It's still going to be less than half of the numbers that we were seeing, say, 6-7 years ago.
But the numbers of kids is going up.
What's happening is that the number of unaccompanied children from Central America is going up. We're not seeing any increase in children or in migrants in general from Mexico. We are seeing an increase in migrants from three countries in Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. That increase actually started about 3-4 years ago. What we're seeing now is that that wave has finally reached a point at which people have begun to notice.
So why especially from those countries?
Now, you have to keep in mind that all three of these countries already have had very high murder rates. The murder rates in those countries have continued to rise. And the change there has been that, to an increasing extent, the criminal gangs that are responsible for a large proportion of those murders have been targeting children and families. And that is what is really driving, I would say, 2/3 of the migrants that we're seeing crossing the border now from those countries.
Targeting children, why?
These gangs operate extortion rackets. Lately, they've begun to extort families, demanding money and threatening to hurt children if they don't get it. They also recruit children to act for them in a variety of ways. And if families refuse to cooperate, then they can pay a terribly heavy price. In San Pedro Sula, for example, which is the second largest city in Honduras, just last month, in one day, four children in one neighborhood were murdered, the youngest of them 5 years old, murdered and their bodies cut into pieces and then dumped along the roads in that neighborhood because their families had refused to let them work for the gangs.
One narrative emerging from the Republican side of Capitol Hill is that this uptick in child migrants is directly related to President Obama's proposed immigration reforms. Here's House Speaker John Boehner on Thursday, for example.
Along our southern border, we've got a true humanitarian crisis underway with children caught in the middle. Unfortunately, it's a crisis of the president's own making. His actions gave false hope to children and their families. If they enter the country illegally, they would be allowed to stay.
So how much can we say that this surge is related to policy?
Well, it isn't really, not at all.
Not at all?
Not at all. There's no evidence whatsoever to indicate that any of this has to do with immigration policy, with the promise of immigration reform, or with actions such as the DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program.
The DREAM Act.
The DREAM Act, right. What's really clear is that the children are fleeing gang violence for the most part. These children are not only fleeing to the U.S., many of them are also seeking asylum in neighboring countries such as Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico. Also, many of these children have been interviewed by a variety of people. I spoke with a woman who's been in El Salvador since January and has interviewed more than 400 migrant children. And these are all children who had been deported back to El Salvador. Of the 400 she spoke with, one brought up the possibility of immigration reform as having been something that had even occurred to them.
But do we have any way of knowing how many of the kids who wind up in Texas are there because of economic opportunity or because they're fleeing for their lives?
Well, we do have some idea, yeah. The UN Human Rights Commission has done some studies themselves. This woman that I just mentioned, Elizabeth Kennedy, the Fulbright scholar, who's also talked to a lot of these kids, and we've talked with a number of them. The information all seems to indicate that probably in about a third of the cases, especially when we're talking about older teens, they are in fact coming for economic reasons. So that's still a factor. It's just that I would say in about 2/3 of the cases, it's really fleeing from violence that is the determining motivation.
Isn't the promise of immigration reform still a motivator? There have been reports of rumors of free passes in Central America that are encouraging people to send their children to the U.S. Here's a clip from Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson in a hearing on Capitol Hill.
The smuggling organizations are creating a misinformation campaign that there is a permisos or free pass. I've even heard that you have to get here by May 2014 in order to get your free pass.
So, you were recently in Honduras and El Salvador, where a lot of these miners are coming from. What did you see while you were there?
Well, it's not the case that there is any kind of misinformation campaign in the media in these countries. In fact, I would say the media outlets have actually been quite responsible in describing very accurately the fact that there is no permiso or free pass.
In fact, in an article you wrote, you quote a front page headline of La Prensa Gráfica, one of the largest papers in El Salvador, that said, "The U.S. will not give asylum to migrant children." It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, very straightforward. And that has been the tone of the reporting down there. Now, separately, one of our reporters from the Arizona Republic also spent a week in Reynosa, Mexico, talking to migrant children and families that were waiting to cross into the U.S. And it's clear that some of them have, in fact, heard these rumors from smugglers. So there is some truth to what Johnson was saying. But to be clear, that is not what is motivating people to flee. This is a story they're hearing once they're already on the way, once they're in Mexico approaching the border.
What about the coverage that you've seen from your spot at the border bothers you the most? What's the narrative that just strikes you as just unconscionably wrong?
Well, one of the things that really surprises me, I would say, is the reluctance to look at the facts on the ground in those countries. We're seeing a very aggressive push to say that we need to send as many of these kids back as quickly as we can. And one of the people that I spoke with when I was down in El Salvador, I think, put it best, saying that if we act too quickly, we may be sending some of these children to their deaths. And so I think that it's really incumbent on the immigration authorities and on the politicians who are involving themselves in this issue to make sure that we tread carefully when it comes to considering how many of these children actually face the risk of death if they are returned to their homes. I was very intrigued the other day to see coverage of a protest in Murrieta, California, a group of people who had come out to protest against several busloads of children who were being brought into their community for processing. And one of the women was holding a sign that said, "Not our children, not our problem." And to me, the notion that I think is important to keep in mind is these are children. And so I think it is our problem.
Bob, thank you very much.
Happy to chat with you.
Bob Ortega is a senior reporter for the Arizona Republic.
Coming up, can you reduce the influence of money in politics? Sure you can. It starts with pouring money into politics.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. According to Forbes.com, approximately 543,000 new businesses get started each month. If you're thinking about starting a business, learn how LegalZoom can help with DBAs, LLCs, incorporation, trademarks, and more at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. They call it the May Day Super PAC. That's May Day not as in the holiday, but as in the distress call. The emergency is the state of politics in this country, where the Supreme Court says money is speech, and therefore elections are dominated by the loudest voices. Enter May Day Super PAC, which intends to raise ungodly sums of money to elect legislators who will reform the system altogether. Last weekend, just in time for the Independence Day deadline, 50,000 Americans brought May Day to its initial fundraising goal of $5 million, a sum matched dollar for dollar by, yes, big political donors. The founder of May Day is Harvard Law School professor Lawrence Lessig, who says the final hours were touch and go because the American public doesn't necessarily obsess about the corrupting influence of money in politics.
Voters don't care about campaign finance. They never have cared about campaign finance. They didn't care about McCain-Feingold. They don't care about super PACs.
People do not care about campaign finance reform. It is not a voting issue.
You've seen those polls, and they're not riled up about it.
But at least 50,000 people were sufficiently riled up to put May Day PAC over the top, ponying up half the goal in the last 48 hours before the deadline. So now that he has the war chest, how to use big money to fight big money? Lawrence Lessig joins me now. Larry, welcome back to On the Media.
Great to be here.
Gotta begin with the obvious irony. Money buys elections. The law permits it. You want to change the laws. You need to elect friendly members of Congress. So use money to buy elections. What is wrong with that picture?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong because, you know, what we're doing is using an imperfect system to get a more perfect system. Just like, you know, there was a time when only men could vote. Then women pushed men to change that unjust system to make it so men and women could vote both. So that's what we're doing. We're trying to use the system we've got to make a system that people have a reason to believe in again. Look, there's no more than 150,000 Americans who are the relevant funders of campaigns. That's about 0.05% of America, about the same number of people as are named Lester in the United States. And what that does is it produces a world where Congress is responsive to the Lesters and they're not responsive to the rest of us. We've got to change that. And we can change that if we change the way elections are funded.
Where did you come up with the Lester metric?
My first name is Lester, too. So I just happened to know how many Lesters there were in the United States. The internet told me that. And then when I saw the number of relevant funders, it clicked. The United States is Lesterland. That's the fundamental problem with the way we elect people in the United States.
This is not a hot-button issue for most Americans. Why should it be?
It's not a hot-button issue because most Americans don't think there's anything you can do about it. But that produces this politics of resignation. People just kind of accept the status quo, even though they really radically would love to see a different status quo. But if you can give them a plan, a way to see how we could change the influence of money in politics, we think they'll rally to it.
What's the plan?
Well, right now in 2014, we're going to run in five races to demonstrate the thing that people in Washington don't believe, which is that Americans care about the corrupting influence of money in politics, and they want to do something about it. And when we run in those five races and move the dial and win in as many as we can, that will create this recognition that leads us into 2016, when we want to run many, many more races to win a Congress in 2016 committed to fundamental reform in the way elections are funded. And one of the things I think this astonishing goal of raising $5 million in a month did was to give people the sense that there was something we could do, and 50,000 people rallied to doing it.
Well, $5 million in a month is a quixotic undertaking and a triumph to have pulled off. And now you have actually $12 million in the bank with the matching funds and some other stuff that's coming over the transom. But $12 million for a super PAC, in the scheme of things, not that big a sum.
You're right. It's not that big a sum if what we were doing this year was trying to take on every single race where we'd have to win to get a majority in Congress committed to fundamental reform. But this year is not about that. This year is about a pilot in just five races. And so, you know, we're going to have more than $2 million in each of those five races, which is a lot of money. And we think that will be enough to rally people in those districts to this cause.
What kind of legislation are you envisioning that can support the delesterization of the process?
Republicans push the idea of vouchers that they would give out to every voter to support the idea of voters using those vouchers to give to candidates who raise their funds in small dollar chunks only. Democrats like John Sarbanes have a bill called the Government by the People Act that would match small dollar contributions so that candidates can afford to run winning campaigns taking small contributions only. That change would make them responsive to a wider swath of Americans as opposed to the current system where they're obsessively responsive to the Lesters.
Citizens United, the Supreme Court case that ruled that money is essentially, for political purposes, speech, undermined almost all existing campaign finance legislation. How to get around the immovable obstacle that is Citizens United?
The only way to change Citizens United would be to amend the Constitution. You know, look, I'm not actually convinced that we have to worry about Citizens United if we lived in a world where elections were funded by all of us as opposed to the tiniest fraction of the 1% of us. We might have to. Let's see. But the point is, we can make this first step, this first change, without worrying about that problem. And that's the objective of the May Day PAC. Elect a Congress that will bring about that reform so that we can get a Congress responsive to all of us, not just to the Lesters.
Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lester Lawrence Lessig is the founder of May Day PAC and a law professor at Harvard Law School. Let's talk about threats to national security. And to do so, look no farther than musty declassified CIA reports on Soviet television and the lessons of Pearl Harbor. The Pentagon Papers, they aren't. Yet a CIA employee was so frustrated by agency bureaucracy that kept the material out of reach that he filed a Freedom of Information Act request, whereupon he was turned over to the FBI and eventually forced to retire. Jeff Scudder, 19-year veteran of the CIA, was posted to the Historic Collections Division, a now defunct office of the agency that reviewed FOIA requests for documents of interest to academics, CIA personnel, and the public. At the start of his 2-year assignment there, Scudder says he noticed a cache of articles that had been declassified and approved for release a decade earlier, but hadn't been passed along due to bureaucratic intransigence.
After spending time trying to work within the bureaucracy, seeing that I was going to get nowhere there, I went ahead and submitted a FOIA request with the titles of the articles. None of this contained the names of assets, the names of people undercover, code names, keywords, sources and methods that we use to acquire intelligence. Contained none of that. So I hear nothing for about 6 months, and then I get called in, come into the classic, you know, windowless room, be told that, you know, my conversation is being recorded, and presented with that there was an allegation that I had taken classified material out of CIA. And when I asked them what it was, they submitted these FOIA requests, that the group that had received these FOIA requests had made the allegation that they had classified data in them, and so I must have taken classified data out.
What did they allege was classified?
I don't know. Even when I met with the FBI, when I asked them to give me an example of something, they pointed out to a title.
Now, can you tell me what the title is without being sent immediately to Leavenworth?
It was called The Sad Song of Norway. And
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Smuggled out of Langley to your home, The Sad Song of Norway. Oh, my goodness gracious.
And to make it worse, I had done a FOIA request to CIA. They had given me material, one of it being this title. And here the FBI was saying, this title's secret, no foreign, it's classified. So I'm like, well, wait a minute. If I get a FOIA request back from one agency, another can arrest me and say I have classified data. And so we never were able to pin him down on proof of anything was classified.
Okay, now I'm laughing, but less hilarious is the fact that the FBI came to your home with a search warrant and walked away with all your consumer electronics, including your computers, your daughter's Game Boy, and, I don't know, your toaster. Is there an active investigation into espionage?
By government law, if CIA believes there's a leaking of classified info, they have to give it to FBI. Over my, actually 2 years with the agency, I had to move to a different job. I couldn't do overseas travel. I couldn't do domestic travel. And I'd met with the FBI, showed them all sorts of information, answered all of their questions. And then in November of 12, it's out of the blue, FBI raids my house. So I was put on administrative leave where then every day, the next year, I had to call the government between 8 and 10 to let them know I was still here. And finally, in January of 14, my lawyer got a phone call saying, justice has not going to be prosecuting you. The case is closed.
We've read about Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning saying that they had been rebuffed trying to go through channels within their own organizations. The government says they didn't try hard enough. But your story shows that when you do start rattling cages within the bureaucracy, you tend to get shut down, sometimes in a rather punitive fashion. Having experienced what you experienced, putting aside the sad song of Norway for a moment, if you believe that someone at CIA has something very significant that they believe needs to be brought to the public's attention, could you ever advise them to go through channels?
Well, that's the sad point about this. As a 19-year veteran, I was about as CIA as you could be. You know, I was a true believer in the organization. And when I saw this, I thought it was important to follow the regs. If you see something going wrong, to raise it up. Instead, it's like this beef that starts going. He's an outsider. He raised an issue. We must destroy him. And I think for the organization, they got what they wanted. It's a clear sign for every employee in the organization. Look what happened to Jeff. If you raise your head, it'll be cut off. And I just don't see how that builds a good camaraderie or the type of people you want in the organization.
In this story, irony folds into irony kind of like an Escher print. But I have to ask you, this FOIA request that you filed, would it eventually have landed on your desk to determine whether the agency should comply?
It might have. It would have been something passed to us to say, take a look at this. Have we released it? And what they're asking for, can we release it? One of the things I joke about is one of the stories was called Argo, which was the story of the officer and what they did to get the hostages out, which ended up, when it did come out, became a movie and won Best Picture and did a lot of good PR for the agency. And to take hundreds of stories like that and keep them hidden for no reason, I don't see how it benefits the CIA.
Yeah, well, when the movie about Soviet-era television comes out, I think I might take a pass.
But A Sad Song of Norway will be a...
I'm ordering my tickets now. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
Jeff Scudder used to work for the Central Intelligence Agency. He is now a consultant in IT.
Coming up, a reporter recounts Chicago's 4th of July weekend when the fireworks came from gun barrels.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Over the 4th of July weekend in Chicago, there were 82 shootings in which 16 people died. Peter Nikias, the Chicago Tribune's overnight crime reporter, was on the scene at many of them. The nature of his job is chronic violence. The soundtrack of his nights is the police scanner.
I know simulcast, we got the person shot. Multiple calls, 3008 East 81st Street, shots fired originally 80 in exchange. The person shot, they're still...
So in the summer, I'll grab a car, two scanners, a laptop, camera. We'll head out to 31st and Halsted. It's safe. It's near highways. There's a 24-hour CVS and Dunkin' Donuts. The bathrooms are clean. Coffee's always hot. These are basic things that are important if you're going to spend 10 hours out, right? Now, if something pops, if there's a shooting, we'll go to the shooting. You can count on a certain number of them during a shift. So the police department will give out a script and they'll say, you know, male 25 found unresponsive at this location. The offender approached on foot, fired shots, and fled in a car. There's probably a lot more to that that you're not going to get unless you go to the scene. And it may not mean talking to witnesses, because witnesses aren't often forthcoming. Police get to them often before we do, but, you know, you talk to family, to neighbors and residents, piece together what the person's life may have been like, what the conflict that led to this may be doing to the neighborhood. There's just a lot of ways of looking at violence other than just what has been traditionally box score type coverage.
When you are listening to the scanner, do you find yourself zigzagging around the city, not sure about which scene to drive to?
We have nights where it feels like we're chasing ghosts. There'll be a night where three quarters of the victims are walk-in gunshot victims and they leave no crime scene behind, or they give a bad location for where they were shot because they don't want police to find out where they were.
The cliche is it was like a war zone, but amid the bullets zinging all around you, it must really seem that way.
I've never been to war, so I don't want to say that. I've been to more than 400 crime scenes over the past couple of years, and this weekend was the absolute first time where I felt like I wasn't in Chicago. It didn't feel real. It was weightless. There's a helicopter, not just like buzzing on the periphery, but like the thump, thump, thump right over you. There's guys running around in coveralls with rifles, people screaming in the radio that they're still shooting. And then while there's 150 cops or whatever around, somebody shot up a house a couple blocks south. So all the cops go running south. That huge presence, an escalation of force basically from like basic patrol to something more like infantry tactics. There was 30 people shot in 13 hours.
On nights like you spent last weekend, Are you looking for the particulars of a given story? Because after all, these are all individual stories with individual people and individual motives and consequences.
On a good night, we'll get to the why, not just the police department's stated version of why, the actual why, you know, which you get from being at a scene, talking to neighbors, relatives, talking to police who can give you more context about things, and then trying to read the neighborhood a little bit, look for gang graffiti, have neighbors point things out to you. When there's that many shootings, we can't get to the why.
You tend to get impatient when the police and the administration try constantly to put a given spasm of violence in the context of a lower overall homicide rate. Another thing they do is, putting aside urban decay, is talk about moral decay and suggest that you can only put so many cops on the street, but in the end it comes down to values.
As far as the crime is down thing, people get annoyed with that specifically because they don't think it's necessarily an appropriate response to a tragedy. Usually the crime is down statement follows either a bad weekend or an incident where, you know, somebody that's just not involved in the drug trade, not involved in gangs, gets killed. As far as the whole values thing, it doesn't strike me as something somebody would say if they've been out there, because I could tell you personally, like, witnessing these things, it has an effect on you. If you're a kid in Inglewood, for example, this is a 20 block by 22 block neighborhood that on a normal year could see 30 to 40 homicides. What does that amount of trauma do to your development growing up in that, where gunfire is normal, where hearing people screaming is normal, where you're getting woken up by sirens in the middle of the night? Yeah, I get it. Like, it's ultimately an individual's decision to pull a trigger, but there's more at play there. I don't think it's a very nuanced thing to say.
You mentioned the effect that this has on children growing up in this environment. What kind of effect does it have on you? Tell me about your soul. Have you any left?
I think I have probably less faith in people in general than I used to. You know, you see so many bad things, you're like, okay, you know, people basically will disappoint given the opportunity. But then, like, we'll get to a neighborhood, and I was talking to a woman. She's like, yeah, my family was the second black family on the block, and we were so proud. Like, when my parents bought the home, they were doing the American dream thing, right? She didn't want to move because this is her house. So to see people, like, taking a stand and saying, no, I'm not going to let the little gangbangers run me off, that kind of restores your faith a little bit. This job has made me hypersensitive, I think, to other people's emotions. You try to throw up the shield as a defense mechanism, you're not going to be a good reporter. The stories I'm most proud of, we're showing moms using a dead kid down the street as a lesson to their kids. You know, you see people praying over their dead loved ones. And I think if you just say, nope, I got to steel myself to this, I'm not going to let it affect me, you're not going to be able to get any of that. So I feel like I'm more able to connect with people than I was before the job, which is a good thing. Now, I have a hard time sleeping. And I don't know if it's because I work overnights and I got to sleep when it's sunny out, or if it's because of it, like, I hear scanners when I go to sleep. And then not sleeping aggravates everything else. So, like, I have a shorter fuse than I used to. And I can keep it in check. Like, I can feel my blood boiling. I don't punch walls, but I can feel myself getting enraged a lot quicker than I used to.
There's one episode that you reported on that was just heartbreaking. A father whose son lay dead. He was praying for a miracle. Can you tell me?
His whole thing was he just wanted to pray over his son. When he approached the supervisor and the detectives and said, I want to do this, they said, well, we got to finish our investigation up and then we'll let you do it. And so he stuck around just like he said he would. When it was clear they were wrapping up, the sergeant walked over to him and he's like, you know, how you picture your son right now is not how he looks. And if you go see him, you know, that's how you're going to remember him. Just trying to talk him out of it gently. And he's like, no, man, I need to pray for my son. So they walked him over. They didn't rush him. He stood there. He prayed. He walked away, and that was it. They called a fire engine to come hose the blood off the scene, and they hauled him away. I was debating over whether to write this. What I figured was this was something that anybody who's standing out here, anybody watching from anywhere would have seen. The man was comfortable talking to me. He gave me his name, his phone number. I felt like just observing and writing what I saw, stating it as plainly as possible without using flowery language, just say what happened, that it would provide a light into these situations for the public who may not see what it's like unless you have somebody there watching and explaining what it's like for a grieving parent at a crime scene.
Pete, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Nikias covers nighttime cops for the Chicago Tribune.
While Chicago Tribune reporter Peter Nikias arrives first at crime scenes, a thriving community of internet sleuths spend hours at their computers trying to attach names to bodies long, sometimes decades, dead and still unidentified. Deborah Halber's new book about these digital detectives just came out. It's called The Skeleton Crew: How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. The science writer's obsession with these online investigators began suddenly when she was reading her local newspaper.
I came across a photo in the Boston Globe, I think it was 2010, and this woman was just really stunning, sort of auburn hair and these really beautiful eyes and this kind of Mona Lisa smile. And then I realized this wasn't a photograph. It was a reconstruction of a woman who had been brutally murdered in Provincetown, Massachusetts in 1974. And they still didn't know who she was. I ran to my computer and started Googling, and I realized that hers was far from an isolated case, that there were, by one estimate, 40,000 sets of human remains scattered around the country, literally, you know, stowed in the back rooms of morgues, bones in cardboard boxes, people who had been buried in potter's fields. And this struck me as an enormous case of national neglect. So when I started Googling, one of the first things I came across was an organization called the Doe Network, as in Jane and John Doe. Elaborate websites, bulletin boards, databases. People had, over the years, created, it was almost like a gold mine of data that they could mine for information to try to connect missing people with the unidentified.
The things that we think are pretty foolproof, like DNA and fingerprints and dental records. These things are not perfect, and even in some cases, utterly useless.
Yes, the stories in my book all start out a little bit like something you might see on Bones or CSI or Law and Order with a body being found. But unlike those shows, there is no magic board where you can click some buttons or some great computer program where suddenly the person's license and DNA profile pop up. It does not work like that. And in addition, a forensic anthropologist is looking at clues that can be very, very hard to decipher. Age can be off as many as 10 years. A family might have seen a woman in nothing but heels, and then when they reported her missing, her height is off by 2 or 3 inches. A family may not know that their son or daughter has a tattoo. The FBI does oversee a database called the National Crime Information Center. And this is a repository of everything: stolen cars, stolen bonds, stolen guns. And it became also the repository for law enforcement to use for unidentified bodies or body parts. The problem with it was it wasn't really designed for that. Another problem was that medical examiners had no access to it, and they were the ones holding the body, so to speak.
Is there any official database available to these web sleuths?
A really wonderful step in the right direction is a National Institute of Justice initiative called the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, and it's shortened as NAMIS. This is an attempt to assemble all of this information in one repository that is accessible to the public, to law enforcement, to medical examiners. This is fairly recent. It is online. It is not fully populated with all the information out there, but it is definitely a step in the right direction.
You note that these unidentifieds tend to get buried, if not literally, at least in the priorities of local law enforcement. Explain why that is.
No one owns the Does.
The John and Jane Does.
The John and Jane Does. If the person is clearly a victim of a homicide, law enforcement will certainly be on top of it for a little while. But it's really hard to investigate a murder when you don't even know the victim's name. And once they become a cold case, it becomes increasingly difficult.
So you were caught by a detail, a photograph. The web sleuths that you profile in your fascinating book Many of them were drawn in by some detail, some shred of a story, and then one story leads to another.
It is very true that many of the people have almost adopted a single case. There's just something about one person, and it might be a local, that they just find incredibly compelling, and they get kind of sucked in. And then before they know it, they just are engrossed in the work. It's very difficult, detail-oriented, time-consuming, and ultimately can be incredibly frustrating.
Why is it so hard?
Because NamUs is a fairly recent phenomenon, without that kind of central repository, you're just looking all over the place. Public records, Ancestry.com, newspaper clips, archives in libraries. It's literally a needle in a haystack.
Could you profile the average web sleuth that you encountered?
They're a very diverse group, yet I feel like there are a few things they have in common. One of them seems to be that they are very, very smart people who like a challenge and like a mystery, but their day jobs are not as intellectually challenging as they might be. There's one web sleuth in my book who solves a case where the only clue was a decapitated head. It's a story that starts with a trucker at a truck stop in Missouri who spots what looks like an ordinary plastic bucket, but when they went to move it out of the way, they realized it was filled with cement. And over time, some of the cement started to chip away, and it looked like a human jawbone emerging from the cement, like something from an archaeological dig. And law enforcement didn't have much to go on. They did eventually ask one of the most amazing forensic artists, the late Frank Bender, to do a bust based on the skull. His work is astounding. I've seen recreations he's done based on nothing more than a jawbone, and they are just the most vital, lifelike things you can imagine. So Frank came up with a bust of a middle-aged man. He was a little graying, a little jowly. Looked like a really nice guy, like a guy you'd want to pass time of day with while you're online in the post office. But no one seemed to know who this man was. So meanwhile, Ellen Leach is based in Mississippi. She had originally come across the bust, and she just went to work. And this process spanned years and finally came upon a photograph of Gregory May, who was missing from Iowa. Now, during the big gap in time between the head in the bucket was found and Gregory May went missing, and the aftermath, which was that a man was actually on trial for his murder, even though they did not have a body. This would be Iowa's first case of prosecuting a murder case with no body. So they were not very hopeful, but it was almost like one of them called it divine intervention. Suddenly, Ellen's suggestion that this reconstruction matched Gregory May was finally investigated. He was quickly identified, and they were able to get a conviction in the case.
What's your favorite story from the book?
They all strike me as just as fascinating as anything out of a crime thriller or an episode of Bones. So they all have this amazing mystique about them. What really struck me most, though, are the people themselves and their different quirky personalities, their different motives, their different ways of approaching the task. There's a woman named Daphne Owings who has this amazing visual memory. She could scan dozens of images like the one I mentioned of the Lady of the Dunes and then scan missing persons reports. She can just in her mind's eye visualize if there are any that could be potential matches.
And what you're talking about basically are literally hundreds of images of the unidentified remains and hundreds of images of missing persons. So if you don't have that ability, you just can't put those pieces together.
Yes, I call it an enormous game of concentration going on across the entire country.
You started out compelled by a reconstruction that appeared in the Boston Globe. Did you try and find out who it was?
I did, and I discovered that I make a lousy web sleuth. It is just such grueling work. I enlisted the help of one of the people I profile in the book. He also has several solves under his belt. His name is Bobby Lingos. He lives in Quincy, Massachusetts, and he works as a police dispatcher. So he actually has the ability to hook into NCIC as a member of law enforcement. So that's an enormous advantage for him. So I called up Bobby and I was like, you've got to help me. I really want to try to do this. We're going to look for Lady of the Dunes, the reconstruction that I had seen in the Globe of the woman who had been murdered in Provincetown in 1974, the coldest unsolved case in Massachusetts. But after a few hours of poring through missing person reports, it quickly became apparent to me that I didn't have what it took.
You can't solve the cases, but you're the bard of these cases.
Right.
Deborah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Deborah Halber is a Boston-based science writer. Her book is called The Skeleton Crew: How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Andrew Chug. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. They're one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.